That's the fundamental question here. What is the locus of sovereignty? And Mark Zuckerberg is saying, I'm the locus of sovereignty. I determine free speech. I have a Supreme Court. I have a currency. The government should support me and regulate me, but I am the locus of legitimacy. And Elizabeth Warren and many others, it's not just her, there are a lot of other politicians that are saying this, but she's the most high profile one, are saying, no, no, it's public institutions. It's the public through its elected leaders that makes the decisions about how society should be governed.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. I was glad to have the chance to talk with Matt Stoller. Matt is a fellow at the Open Markets Institute, who's written a very readable and informative book called Goliath on Monopoly Power in the 20th Century. Matt has a strong and focused perspective on the politics of our time. Before his current work, Matt worked at the Senate Budget Committee, and before that he worked in the U.S. House of Representatives on financial services policy. I visited Matt in his home in Logan Circle in D.C. to discuss the battle between democracy and concentrated power. And if that's the battle, I'm rooting for democracy. So, after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with Matt Stoller of the Open Markets Institute.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
Hi, Matt.
How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure. My name is Matt Stoller. I'm the author of Goliath, the 100-year war between monopoly power and democracy. And I'm a fellow at the Open Markets Institute. I spent about 6 years on Capitol Hill and have done various things in television and stuff on housing finance policy, competition policy, trade. I've also written for a bunch of magazines and newspapers.
Tell me about the Open Markets Institute. What is that exactly?
So it's a think tank. We focus on the problem of monopoly. And we believe that there's a crisis of capitalism right now, which is not so much that we have markets, it's that we have monopolies. And monopolies now control a whole bunch of parts of our society through controlling markets. The big stuff like search and social, like Google and Facebook, airlines, cable companies, that kind of thing, concentrated power, pharma, everybody knows about that. But then small things like peanut butter, syringes, baby formula, bank management software, and everywhere in our culture, you see this concentrations of power in the private sector, which then increases inequality, stagnates wages, reduces innovation, lowers productivity, corrupts our politics. So that's what we think about. I wrote Goliath because I wanted to explain the history of the politics of monopoly. It goes over the last 100 years and talks about how we've actually had the problem that we have now in the first part of the century when robber barons controlled our culture and our politics, and we actually fought them and won. And then in the second half of the century, really starting in the 1970s, we allowed those robber barons to come back and roll that forward, kind of the policy changes in the late 1970s, early 80s, you roll that forward 40 years, here we are.
So you think that a great deal of the mess we're in has to do with monopoly right
now? I do, yeah.
And what do you think is the biggest mess we're in that's due to monopoly?
The biggest political problem that we have is that the people themselves, that we have lost faith in politics and democracy and the rule of law. We do polling on monopoly, and one of the things we find is nobody likes monopolies. It's like a 90 to 10 issue, right? And I don't mean 90% of people don't like monopolies and 10% do like them. I mean 90% of people don't like them and 10% don't know. But the one argument that works isn't monopolies are good for you or they're efficient or whatever. It's they're too powerful. The government can't do anything, right? And I think that that's generally what you find across our culture when you say things like, well, we really should use the rule of law. There's a lot of, well, nobody went to jail for the financial crisis. So there's a kind of lack of faith that the law actually applies to anyone but the powerless.
If you were in charge of the regulatory body, and what's it, FTC, that would deal with this?
Yeah, there's a bunch of them.
Yeah, but if you were appointed to be in charge of that, not inconceivable, I guess, in the right election, what would be the first monopoly you would tackle and why?
I think I'd probably go after Google or Amazon. And the reason is that, you know, you want to take on the most powerful ones that are threatening our democracy just so they start to behave better. When you do break up a company like that, everybody notices. And then every business leader will say, I don't want to do what Google did, right? And 10,000 lawyers in corporate America all of a sudden issue a memo to their clients saying, hey, this is what you should avoid doing. So antitrust has this catalytic effect on business across the board. You don't need to bring a 100,000 antitrust suits to stop 100,000 monopolies. You just need to bring a few. And then they will decide that they don't want to be the next target.
If Google needed to be broken up, what would be the pieces that would make sense?
Well, Google has 8 products with more than 1 billion users. So there's some things that might have some kind of leverage. Let's say that Google Search, general search, and Google Local Search, you could make an argument that those products need to belong together just for efficiency's sake. They might draw from the same database. They might have the same users. I'm not sure. I think you need to look into it carefully. But there is no argument that, say, YouTube and Google General Search have to be in the same company. There's no reason for that.
Google bought YouTube.
Google, exactly. Yeah. They bought YouTube. They bought DoubleClick. They bought the original company behind Maps. Google is a whole set of what I call information utilities. They shouldn't be under the same roof. They cut deals with each other on preferential terms simply because they're in the same Google conglomerate structure, right? And that's inefficient, right? Google Maps should be cutting deals with anybody in the economy, not prioritizing its deals with Google or with other Google subsidiaries. First, you need to do a big examination of the company. But then once you break them up into these component parts, some of those component parts are themselves monopolistic. So you might have to make rules that would break up those monopolies. So as an example, Google Maps has a large amount of data, which is, you know, all of the places and the shape of buildings. You know, they have really granular data. That data could be shared. You could force Google to license that on non-discriminatory terms to competitors. And that way, you all of a sudden, you would see this explosion of mapping in the mapping industry. You could do that too with Google General Search. They have this web crawl, which is just kind of all the sites in the English language web and then most languages. That could be a public utility. You could say you have to license the crawl to anybody for a non-discriminatory fee. And then all of a sudden you'll see an explosion of search engines trying different ways to please customers. And if you look at the Google that way, then all of a sudden it can be the foundation for a whole set of new, really vital industries instead of what it is now, which is just basically a slothful set of toll booths that feed unhappy engineers with gourmet food.
Well, I doubt it's slothful.
It is absolutely slothful. Yeah. It is an inefficiently, badly run organization.
That's not what I think people think about Google.
Well, right? That's true, but they spend a lot on PR, right?
Yeah.
It's not a well-run organization. Larry Page is the CEO, and he like spends his time like trying to figure out how to make flying cars. Like, this is not a company that is spending time thinking about the problems that they are actually in charge of dealing with. And even if they were, even if the CEO, Larry Page is the CEO of Alphabet, I think it's Sundar Pichai, who's the CEO of Google itself. But like, even if Sundar Pichai is a good CEO, 8 products with more than 1 billion users, you cannot run a company that big. It doesn't matter how smart you are. You just don't have enough time to think about the problems that something that size causes.
I'm pretty confident that you're right, that there would be some benefits to breaking up something like Google, and you could have named a lot of others. But we've kind of lost that ideological battle at this point. Not for good, but like for the moment. If you go to the American people about Google and you say, I want to break this up into eight pieces that you might just hear, actually, we like this company the way it is, maybe because of their PR.
We've done polling, about two-thirds of Americans support an antitrust suit against Google. So you can distinguish between, say, flight, right, and American Airlines, right? People know that the technology is different from the political institution that we've created to house that technology. So you can structure things in many different ways, and the public is sophisticated enough to understand the arguments that you can make. So it's certainly the case that if you were to say, we're going to take Google away from you, people would reject that. But if you say, we think Google has too much power and we're going to restructure it so that there are open competitive markets, you'll find a lot of support for that.
If that's true, why so far hasn't that happened?
Why didn't we prosecute any Wall Street bankers for the mass fraud that they perpetrated? Like, why is the Sackler family, which they're heroin dealers with opioids, like, why are they sort of negotiating a settlement that allows them to keep billions of dollars? The CEO, former CEO of WeWork, is going to walk away a billionaire. That's a fraud, or it's definitely a con. The problem is our whole culture is off kilter, and we have allowed concentrations of power that are so extreme. And it's because we don't enforce the law on the powerful. And that's what you're seeing. That's why Trump was elected. It's why you're seeing aggressive debates in the Democratic Party. It's why you're seeing people talking about socialism, getting rid of capitalism, these kinds of things. It's like people are not happy. And it's because we've lost something very basic about the American culture, which is the rule of law that is applied to the powerful. So we haven't lost that ideological debate. We didn't fight it from the 1970s onward, and now we're starting to fight it again. I go into this in Goliath. There was a debate in the 1970s, and what they decided was we are going to take corporate power and banking power, which had been this fundamental axis of America, all the way going back to Hamilton and Jefferson. Remember, the Democratic Party was founded out of opposition to the National Bank, Hamilton's National Bank. And then the French Revolution happened, and that was really the genesis of the Democratic Party itself. In fact, the first song or sort of slogan for the Democratic, it wasn't a slogan, but it was the song. The people who were eventually became the Democratic Republican Party sang the Marseillaise to celebrate the French Revolution victory over the aristocrats. And this was very much an opposition to Hamilton and Hamilton's concentrations of power in the hands of financiers. That's our politics. That goes into the 1970s. That's 200 years. Then they convince everyone on the left and the right that corporate power and banking power is science and just let the economists handle it, right? So we went to sleep for 40 years while these giants kind of consolidated power. And we didn't understand what was going on around us because antitrust was this very technical area. It was this little clubhouse. And now, kind of starting in 2015, 2016 or so, but really going back, you know, too big to fail banks, the crisis and Trump, a whole kind of a set of reasons. And then what we do at Open Markets, we've made the case that actually what's happened is a philosophical breakdown. And that's why you're seeing a resurrection of these old political debates and these old political ideas about concentrations of power.
So where do you think those debates are happening politically right now? I don't remember Trump campaigning on monopoly power, pro or con.
He did.
Tell me more about that.
He talked about the AT&T Time Warner merger. He said that's too much concentration of power in too few hands. He said it. I'm not kidding. He definitely talked a lot about trade and trade, which he framed as a power question. But yeah, he talked about, you know, Bezos's Amazon antitrust problem. Like, absolutely, the guy talked about competition and monopolies. Trade was a massive part of his campaign, and trade is definitely about power and about the distribution of economic power. Now, he also ran a racist campaign on immigrants, right? And you often see this when you have a society that is deeply, deeply unhappy with the breakdown of the rule of law. These kind of demagogues come by and they make these kind of populist arguments on the left, and then they also bring in these very toxic, anti-Semitic or racist or misogynistic, often a strong combo, a milkshake of all of them. That's what kind of Trump is, kind of a faint echo of some earlier autocrats. But absolutely, he did talk about antitrust. There was some anti-monopoly stuff in the Republican platform. And then, of course, there was anti-monopoly stuff in the Democratic platform. And Hillary Clinton had an antitrust plank. And Bernie Sanders talked about antitrust. And Tim Kaine on Meet the Press, VP candidate, talked about AT&T Time Warner. So absolutely, it's there. It wasn't kind of as big as you've seen it today, But it was there.
What do you think the administration has done in its actual governing on the antitrust front?
Oh, they've been terrible. I mean, they've helped big tech in a number of different ways. Kind of behind the scenes, they've filed friend of the court briefs to encourage consolidation of power. They've enabled the merger of Sprint T-Mobile, right, which is blatantly illegal. They've been absolutely pathetic. And this is because of Joe Simons at the FTC and Machen Delrahim at the DOJ and Ajit Pai at the FCC. There's a lot of corruption there. They're trying to put pro-monopoly laws like the Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act into our trade agreements, like into the new NAFTA, into WTO, into an agreement with Japan, potentially into an agreement with England. So it's bad. But the thing is that it's what's happening is that on a state level, like the conservative Republican Attorney General of Texas, Ken Paxton, is now leading a 50-state investigation of Google. And then Tish James, the liberal Democratic AG of New York, is leading a, I think it's a 47-state investigation of Facebook. And then you have Congress, where David Cicilline, who's the chair of the antitrust subcommittee, is leading a bipartisan investigation of all four big tech companies. We'll leave out Microsoft because apparently they're kinder and gentler these days, although I would be skeptical of that. But that's what's happening. And really, you know, William Barr, he understands power. He was the general counsel of Verizon and Time Warner. And he doesn't like Google and Facebook because his corporate, you know, people he worked for don't like them. And so now he's taken control of the DOJ antitrust division, and he's starting to force the DOJ antitrust division to actually do something about Google and Facebook. I would be surprised if you don't see real suits coming out of the states and then out of the DOJ.
It sounds like the relationship between how to regulate monopoly and the political parties is pretty complicated right now.
Well, just be careful when you say regulate monopoly, because regulated monopoly is different than breaking up monopolies.
Okay.
Just to clarify. Like, yeah. And philosophically, you regulated monopoly is the way that more autocratic systems work. And then regulated competition, where you break up those monopolies right. And you create rules, is a way that you can...
Sort of the distinction you were making between Roosevelt,
Teddy Roosevelt, yeah,
and,
right.
and Wilson.
That's right. That's yeah. right.
So in terms of breaking up monopolies then, how do you see that intersecting with the two parties and their different wings and so on?
Both sides are actually having this debate. So you see a lot of Republicans, Democrats don't believe me when they say this, but because I've been in Democratic politics for 15 years and everybody's always like, oh, I can get a Republican on blah, 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 right? And then it's always nonsense, right? They're never like bipartisan. But if you actually look at the intellectual world of the right, like the conservative movement, not necessarily the politicians, but the conservative movement, the people that are really building these kind of thought collectives, which is where all idea generation happens. There is a lot of debate there about what to do about inequality and these concentrations of power, because they understand that Trump is a bad sign for their party and they want to change it. And I think that on the Democratic side, you know, there is a real kind of attempt to grapple with the failures of the Obama administration. It's not as, I think, aggressive as what's happening on the right. But what you're seeing on the right is you're seeing, you know, I think the leader, the intellectual and political leader is Josh Hawley, who's a senator from Missouri. He's done a lot of really important work on Facebook and Google. He's done some important work on trade and a little bit on pharma. And he's breaking with the Koch brothers, right? So there's a battle between the Koch brothers and this kind of new socially conservative wing of the party. And then on the other side, and he's got some allies. It's a little bit of a lonely battle, but he, you know, look at the state level, you see all those AGs acting. So he's got the momentum is with the Josh Hawley's of the world. Tom Cotton's part of that as well. And Doug Collins and various others. But then on the Democratic side, you know, you have obviously Elizabeth Warren, who's called for breaking up big tech. You see Bernie Sanders, you saw Cory Booker, Amy Klobuchar has said some interesting things. I mean, even Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg have some stuff in antitrust in their various plans, although they've been pretty soft on big tech. So you're seeing this debate happening. And in a lot of ways, it's very weird because, you know, Goliath, my book, is this kind of deep dive into the history of these debates. And I'm finding that there's a lot more interest on the right than on the left. And it's very weird. The left seems like fairly uninterested in these kind of, they're not interested in business. They're not really interested in power. They're not really interested in these questions of defense. it doesn't seem like politics to them. And that's really, I think, a hangover from the 1970s. The left, in a lot of ways, is still living in the 1970s, at least the intellectual parts of the left.
And you're saying that even about like Warren and Sanders?
No. Warren and Sanders are not, you know, Warren and Sanders are throwbacks to like left populism. So is AOC. I mean, AOC talked about Zuckerberg, you know, last week. But I'm just talking about like Katie Porter's great. You know, she's a good example. But when you talk to most Democrats, like, and a lot of people on the left, you know, what you'll find is they're just not interested in business, right? And the thing about Goliath and the story that I just sort of discovered is that in America, how we do business is how we do justice. Like Plessy v. Ferguson was about a railroad, right? It was about discrimination, racial discrimination on a railroad. And railroads, that was the big business of its day. If you look at how we think about justice itself, it's about often, not always, but often, the choices that we make about commerce. Robert Bork, who killed antitrust, he made his kind of important first political statement in 1963 when he attacked the Civil Rights Act, particularly Title II, which was the title that said that people that own hotels and restaurants have to serve all comers regardless of race. And he said that, look, I'm not racist. I think the government shouldn't discriminate. But if you have property, like you own a restaurant or you own a hotel, it's an impingement upon your freedom to have to serve people with whom you would not choose to associate, which is a statement about property. And the converse, which was the Civil Rights Act, which said you have to serve everyone, is also a statement about property. It's a common carriage rule. It goes back hundreds of years into Anglo-American tradition. It's saying, we define property as a society, and one of the elements of property rights means that you have to serve all comers.
So what was the genesis of this book? How did you decide, I'm going to write a book on the history of the competition between government and monopoly?
The genesis of this book is really the financial crisis. So I was a staffer for a member of Congress who started working in the Financial Services Committee in 2009. And, you know, I didn't really know that much about finance, but I knew a lot about corruption and I knew something about politics. And my orientation was, Matt, here's a desk. Good luck with the financial crisis, right? That's it. And the nice thing about that is that though I didn't know much about finance or banking, no one else did either. As it turns out, the lobbyists wore suits and they knew how to talk in certain tones, but it was pretty obvious that nobody knew what was happening in the banking world. Not the bankers, not the lobbyists, not the Treasury.
It was damn complicated.
It was just all that gibberish is covering up for something very simple. Gambling with other people's money. That's all it was. That's what every financial crisis is. It's just gambling with other people's money and then you have a collapse because that's what happens.
So did you start thinking as you were a staffer, I got to write a book on this, or when does that happen?
No. So what I did when I was on the Financial Services Committee, I started asking financial bloggers about what was happening because they seemed to be angry because they were financial professionals who actually saw things go wrong and were writing on the internet about it. So I started to do outreach to them and then I developed a network of sources. And one of the sources was this woman named Jane DeRista, who is an economist who knew a lot about what was going wrong. And I said, how do you know all this? Well, that market's going to blow up. And then it did. You know, how do you know that? And she's like, oh, well, I worked on the banking committee in the 1970s, 60s and 70s, when they were taking it apart. And I learned under this guy, Wright Patman, who had been there in the 30s when they put this system in place. So he knew what it was there for. And I was like, oh, that's really interesting. And I learned a lot about Wright Patman. But I was really interested in finance. And then a couple of years later, I read a book by Barry Lynn who deals with monopoly. And one of his books was about, or one of the pieces of the book was about chain stores. And he wrote about how this law called Robinson-Patman used to constrain the A&P and that the A&P was like the Walmart of its day in the 1920s and 30s. And that when we stopped enforcing it in the 1970s, that's when Walmart exploded. And I was like, well, wait a second, that's the same guy. That's Patman, right? Patman, he did both. And then I started to ask Jane about him. And then I started studying his life. And then I realized, oh, there's this whole tradition there. And he got his start impeaching Andrew Mellon, who was Hoover's Secretary of the Treasury and the third richest man in the country in 1932, owned three Fortune 500 companies, chairman of the Fed, and controlled the Bureau of Revenue, which is the IRS. And then also the Treasury Secretary.
And celebrated as a great Treasury Secretary until they try to impeach him. That's after right. Things go wrong.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then Patman was the first Democrat to actually investigate Watergate in 1972 before the election. And then in 1975, when the new class of Watergate babies which is what the New Democrats were called, who were elected in reaction to Nixon. One of the first things that they did is they got rid of Patman as the chair of the banking committee, the guy who had helped elect them, and this old kind of populist. And it turns out they were being manipulated by the bankers to do that. And that was kind of around the time, 75, 76, that's when you saw this kind of new ideology take hold in both the Democratic and Republican parties.
Then you move out of off the hill and into some think tanks. Right. Are you percolating this idea then?
Yeah, so I'm doing research. And then, you know, 2013, I go back onto the hill. So the guy I worked for lost in 2010. I went to some think tanks, did some writing, did some TV producing. The foreclosure crisis, I did a lot of work on that. And I was like, why did we make all these bad decisions? And ultimately what happened in 2013, 2014 is I started to write this book and started to do research and put the idea together. And the driving animus was a question, which is, why did we screw up so badly in 2009? Like, I saw us screw everything up in the crisis, and it wasn't because people were corrupt. Yes, there were some people who were corrupt, but mostly it was just a bunch of bad decisions that were all tilted one way. And so I tried to understand, why is that? What happened? And it really, the answer is ideology. We had this ideological turn in the 1970s, and the people that were in charge in 2008 had learned, either had been part of those ideological battles in the 70s, or had learned from people who had been part of those battles. And that's the story that I tell about our political economy, that history. I majored in history, but I didn't know any of this. And so I wanted to tell a story about power and power through corporations and banks.
You were a history major at Harvard. Did you study under labor historians, financial historians? Was there any of the work that you did there that was relevant to this, or more just like how to do history?
No, I didn't. Nothing was relevant. I mean, Harvard History Department was terrible, right? I mean, they were just bad, and because they didn't want to understand power. And this was in the 90s when everything was, you know, awesome, right? The economy was great. What I was interested in then was how Keynesianism got into America. And I started looking at the New York Times and Keynes and trying to understand that. And there was really little interest at the time in political economy. So I took a class from a guy named Sven Becker, who taught a course on the Gilded Age. I wasn't hugely interested in becoming a historian. Sven Beckert's written wonderful work recently on it's called a book called The Empire of Cotton, which is about cap. So I think like one of the things that has happened in the last 15, 20 years is that you've seen this kind of revision of our philosophy of how the world works. And I'm not saying that they never taught me, you know, this stuff and that's really bad. It's like we were all enthralled to these really bad ideas and this whole vision of social justice, which is warped and doesn't suit human beings, that really took hold in the 70s. And that was true when I went to college in the 90s. I think that stories matter, and I think that people need to know their history, and I think history is fun. And the weird shit that happened in the 19, like in every decade I looked at, one of the things that I love is every financial scam, not every single one, but most financial scams have to do with either Florida real estate or Citibank. It's usually one of those two things or both. They're so stupid. That's the fun thing about it. It's like people can be so dumb. There was this one financial scam that's in the book in 1925. Everyone was speculating on Florida real estate, and like people kept bidding up property in this one town called Nettie, Florida, which turned out not to exist, which I loved. I just love that story. And then in 1970, there's this train system which goes bankrupt. This is the kind of the Enron of its day. They do a chapter on this thing called Penn Central, sort of the first modern bailout. And one of the things that these idiots were doing who were running Penn Central is they were tired of running a train system. So they just started gambling on like buying stock and various other things. One of the things they did is they started buying, again, Florida real estate. It's always the stupidest thing. And then in the crisis, of course, it was Florida real estate.
You know? Well, what was the process then? How did you work this through the 400 pages that you worked on?
Right. I wanted to tell a story. You know, there's a lot of books that are about politics. Like, hey, I'm a guy that thinks we should do blah. I wanted to just sort of go into the archives and just explain what happened. But I also didn't want to fall into the trap of what I call the memo problem, where you write a memo of what happened. I wanted to tell a story and give a motivation to the people that were doing what they were doing. So there's this one point where Andrew Mellon's brother is being asked in 1928, you know, he's being put on the spot about the coal mines, and a senator says to him, hey, you know, can you run a coal mine you know, without machine guns? And he's like, I really don't see how you could run a coal mine without machine guns. I mean, and then it was like this hugely embarrassing moment and he kind of went back on it. But it's like, why did Richard Mellon say that? Why did Andrew Mellon do what he did? Right? These are three-dimensional flesh and blood characters. Andrew Mellon was a very cold, cynical man, but he also had a vision of social justice, which aligned him in many ways with Mussolini. And he would talk about Mussolini in the election speeches for Herbert Hoover in 1928. Why is that? Well, they were really afraid of the Soviet Union at that point. The Soviet Union was new, and there was this decade in the 1920s where people really lost their faith in democracy. I mean, more than they have now. Like, the U.S. Army in one of their training manuals said, you know, democracy is dangerous, it's demagogic, and all of these other things. Like Walter Lippmann, a very kind of liberal guy, wrote two books in the 1920s on how democracy was sort of an illusion. This is a very corporatist decade, a decade where the KKK is very powerful. And you really have to understand why, like the depths of disillusionment that induced that. And then going forward, I really wanted to understand why the baby boomers did what they did. I wanted to understand why business leaders organized in the 1970s. It's not like they just became greedy in 1971 and decided to form a business roundtable, you know, and the Powell memo and all. Like, they were greedy in 1961. They were greedy in 1951. Why 1971? And it was because the whole train system went bankrupt. And their buddies in, you know, the executive suite had a lot of trouble. And they then all of a sudden became afraid. And so that's what caused the debate of the 1970s. And so I'm not trying to demonize anyone. I'm trying to explain why people thought what they thought, because I really genuinely think it's more truthful and scarier if people do what they do for good reasons, because they mean well, and still things turn out either wonderfully or really badly. I really feel like that's the story of humanity. It's not a story of like cynical, greedy people just trying to steal everything. It's a story of people kind of struggling to figure out the day.
And probably taking the viewpoint of whatever institution that they're in. If you're a big financier, you're going to kind of behave like one. You know, if you own a Fortune 500 company, you're going to act in its best interest as you see it.
It's different because big financiers operated differently in the 1950s than they do today. You're going to respond. It's like your favorite music is the music that you listened to growing up. You can be 50 years old or 70 years old or 30 years old. It's like the song that you heard when you were 15, you know, at this really meaningful moment. That's good music, right? Something similar goes on with how people think about business and how they think about justice and power. It's like a lot of the people today that are in power or that were in power in 2008, they were thinking about the 1970s or 1980s and the inflation and the squeegee men and all the crime and all these things that don't exist today, or the street crime. And it's like the music that you hear when you're 15. The bankers who are 35 today or who are 25 today just think differently than the bankers that are 55 or 65. And they went through different experiences and they have different ideas. So ideas really are, in many ways, institutions matter. Ideas often live in institutions, but people within institutions can disagree, and ideas can be independent of institutions.
What do you hope for from this book in terms of the reaction of people reading it and how it might change how people are thinking about this big challenge?
One of the things that's been really neat is for people who actually took antitrust from Robert Bork, right? Really powerful or very experienced people who have read this book and who have said, I had no idea what happened. I always was taught this stuff that seemed to make sense to me, and then I didn't understand why the world went crazy. And this book finally explains it. The other kind of neat thing is to hear from young people who are reading it and are seeing through this book a lens that they can use to make sense of the world around them and feel less lonely and understand that the frustration that they feel is deeply American, because they see a world that is unjust. And they also see that we've had the tools in American history to make that world more just, a more perfect union, and that we just have to use those tools. And that's what's so cool about this story is, like, we've been here before. We've had robber barons before. We've had populist movements before. And we know how to fix it, and we can. And it's our generation, and you know, I don't care how old you are, but at this moment, we have a decision. Do we want to be a free people, or do we want to forego our liberties? And every generation has that choice. And sometimes they choose liberty and sometimes they don't. And we get the honor of making that choice again today.
I've seen that your book has been excerpted in major publications lately. What kind of feedback are you getting so far from people reading it? Are they coming to you and discussing things? Are they giving you the thumbs up or thumbs down? What are you hearing?
It depends. You know, so a lot of people really like it. But then, you know, the right is actually really interested. So are national security people. Like, they're freaked out about China and concentrations of power. They're looking for a new framework. A lot of Democrats are like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you're not talking about how terrible Trump is. So that's kind of annoying. And then you have a lot of the Obama people, not all of them, but a lot of the Obama people, a lot of them are interested. They're like, oh, this is cool. Now I understand why we tried, but we screwed up. And I feel that way too. I mean, I tried and screwed up too. I don't think it's a problem to make mistakes. I do think it's a problem to not acknowledge them. But then you do have a whole bunch of kind of legacy defenders for Obama and Clinton, because this book is really critical of them. And kind of, it's actually really critical of the left going from the 1950s onward. And one of the things that I think they do is they kind of try to make the case that New Dealers were racist. Wright Patman had an interesting and checkered history on race. So they try to frame him as solely defined by that. He fought the Klan in the 20s. He voted for segregation in the 50s because there were segregationist primary challengers. He passed anti-discrimination legislation in the 60s. It's a complex history and a really interesting one. But, you know, Jay Carney, who's the VP of public policy for Amazon and worked in, and I think he was the press secretary for Obama. A lot of them never acknowledge me. They like to like attack me. I know they're obsessed with the work that I do, but they don't acknowledge me because they don't want to give me attention. They don't want to legitimize what I'm saying in this history because they're afraid of it. But they do kind of like subtweet me, which is to say that they will mention things and attack them, but never mention my name. That's a very common thing you see in the sort of fading liberal tastemaker world. But, you know, the right is interested. A lot of liberals are interested. A lot of people in finance and business are interested. I mean, this is a cool area and it's not partisan. And I'll just say this, the only two things coming out of Congress that are getting any press are impeachment and then the antitrust subcommittee investigation of Google, Facebook, Amazon, and Apple. Because they do hearings sometimes, they're doing a big investigation, and they always get a ton of press.
I've read several reviews of the book in different places.
Right.
I wonder how you react to a review. I've seen some that are very complimentary. I've seen ones that say, oh, this is too much of a unified theory, say.
Sure.
Or you don't present the other side of arguments very well. Those have been the typical criticisms that I've read. Of the criticisms you've read, what do you think is most valid, if any?
Well, look, I mean, Rob Atkinson from the National
Review.
He's
a smart guy.
Yeah, he's a smart guy, but he's also a Google lobbyist, right? I mean, he works for Google and Qualcomm and a bunch of monopolists. Like, it's the voice of concentrated capital speaking. And then this guy, Lloyd Green, who is a lawyer for hedge funds and tax havens, he did a review in The Guardian. One of the points of the book is that concentrated capital monopolists and financiers have their own vision of social justice. And I don't think they're driven by pecuniary interests solely. I think they're driven by a real view that aristocracy is a good system. It's a better system than democracy. Like, there's a very technocratic element to the way that they see the world. And I've also been in sort of arguments on the University of Chicago Booth School of Business blog called Pro Market with a bunch of sort of Chicago school people. And then there's left-wingers who are concentration people, the socialists. They don't like it either. They have a number of different arguments, but basically what they say is that they have a bunch of data that they point to and they say, oh, big business is more efficient, it's better. And I fairly characterize all of that. I mean, I'm telling a story of what monopolists and financiers think. I explain what they think. I don't think it's a very fun story if you're not fair to the people in the book. And I explain why people bought into Mellon's ideas. I explain why people didn't. I think it's sort of stupid to just sort of mischaracterize your opposition. They were a little bit unfair in the way that they made the critiques. But what Rob said is an important perspective because he's making the argument. So Lloyd Green made this too. Their argument is, look, Amazon is good for consumers. And Matt never addressed that. First of all, my book's not about Amazon. Amazon's in the last chapter. It's not an important part of the story. It becomes important later, but it might be good for consumers or it might not be good for consumers. But it's bad for democracy. And I make that argument, but I also portray their argument. To have a tension in, just as a writer, to have narrative tension, you have to have two sides.
You also have a recent article in the Times, right, about democracy and the, it's like Facebook.
Big tech,
If I have a real big worry right now about monopolies and our democracy. It's centrally in the way that we're getting news and the way journalism has been undermined. And I think you're making a really important point there. But can you make that now? Explain what you're saying there.
Yeah. So basically, you know, Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg likes to talk about free speech, blah, 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 blah. Should I censor this way or that way? But like, let's be honest. Facebook's an advertising company. They had about $60+ billion of revenue that's ads. And that's coming from journalism, right? And publishers. We used to have a bunch of journalists who were hired with that money. And now it's a bunch of engineers in Palo Alto driving up property values. And Google, the same thing, about twice as much revenue or so. And like, that's a lot of money that used to go to financing news gathering that's now going to financing the manipulation of ourselves, right? Through these manipulations.
Our feeds,
right? Yeah. And you know, searches and yeah. maps and YouTube and stuff like yeah. that, you know.
Everything we're seeing on a little device.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's global too. I mean, in Brazil, you know, here you see white supremacy and anti-vaxxers. In Brazil, you have, you know, people are obsessed now with the idea that the Zika disease is caused by vaccines because of like crazy conspiracy theories on YouTube. That's all a function of the business model, which is to distort the flow of information to serve themselves, to serve Google and Facebook, and also to serve their advertisers who pay them. So we have a very basic choice, and this is the point of the op-ed. Do we want democracy and liberty and a society in which we the people govern and a society that's sustainable, or do we want slightly more relevant advertising?
So what's the move that we can make? Okay, say there's a breakup move that you talked about.
Yeah, you break it
up. But what's the move that you can make that drives revenue back to the non-existent local papers and stuff.
It's very simple.
Yeah.
Ban advertising on communication networks. Just know if you are a communication network, you cannot finance yourself through advertising or an information utility. Larry Page and Sergey Brin in 1998, before they found Google's business model, said advertising is inherently corrupt in a search engine. It will destroy the integrity of a search engine.
We have a clean page.
Right. But also we don't self-deal. We don't prioritize our advertisers and we don't try to keep you on our website. And you can't, there's no way to get around that if you'd start accepting advertising.
What are the prospects for something like that happening?
I think we'll do it. Yeah. I think we're going to, look, the business model itself is obviously corrupt of both, you know, of all of these information utilities, right? They're causing so much damage. And people are getting around their heads around the idea of breakups. They're getting their heads around the idea of regulating data. So it's not that hard to say, hey, let's actually look at the core problem here, which is advertising. So advertising has a corrupting influence everywhere, including in media. But the way we've dealt with it in media is it's never been perfect, but we accepted the deal that advertising would finance news gathering, and we would mitigate the corrupting effects through cultural signals like the separation of editorial and journalism, but also through diversity of media outlets. So we accepted some of the corruption. We have diversity of advertisers and newspapers, and also signaling functions like the New York Times being different than the National Enquirer. We don't have any of that set up for communication networks. But what the corrupting influence of advertising done to communication networks is it causes them to seek to addict us, to prioritize cheap, fraudulent clickbait, to engage in surveillance. All of that is a function of the fact that they want to keep us on their platforms and sell us ads and know who we are as we look at those ads. So the way to deal with that problem is very simple. Don't let them run communication networks financed with a corrupt channel. Force us to pay money for communication technologies. That's what we've done historically, really up until the 1990s. You know, we pay for our phone networks. Just make us do that, and it'll be fine.
I'm sure you've been doing quite a number of interviews about this book. It's typically the fate of an author at this stage. What is a question that you wish you had been asked that you haven't been yet?
Here's a question. What's the one trait that unites anti-monopolists across time and space?
What is the one trait that unites anti-monopolists across time and space?
They hate bullies. Every great anti-monopolist hates bullies.
So do you think that given that we sort of have a bully as president right now, that that provokes a lot of the anti-bullying sentiment that might be out there that we could harness?
I think people see the raw, like kind of visceral nature of what it means to put predators in charge, right? He kind of reveals the ugliness behind the kind of suave Ivy League bullshit that we've been dealing with for a long time.
Do you see Zuckerberg and Bezos as bullies?
They're not the problem, right? Like Zuckerberg, he's a wonderful villain. They're not the problem. The problem is the public policy framework that has allowed them to accumulate the power that they have. They should be moderately successful business people, right, who have created cool products. But instead, they are, you know, making public policy through their private institutions. And that's just crazy, right?
Yeah, it is. Matt, it's really been an honor to talk to you about this book today. Anything else you want to say?
I appreciate you having me. The book's called Goliath, The 100-Year War Between Monopoly Power and Democracy. And I guess the last thing, I guess I will say some one last thing. And that's, you know, as you look through 2020, the most important debate has happened, and I'm not saying Elizabeth Warren's the best candidate. I'm just saying in terms of framing, it's not been between Elizabeth Warren and any of the other candidates. It's actually been between Elizabeth Warren and Mark Zuckerberg. And it's really important to understand that in that debate, in that conflict, is a question, which is the question that we've been asking ourselves for 200 and something years, which is who governs in our country and in our world? Is it we the people? Is it a democracy? Is it people that have rights and can live as a free people? Or is it a private monopolist, a private government that we call a monopoly or corporation? That's the fundamental question here. What is the locus of sovereignty? And Mark Zuckerberg is saying, I'm the locus of sovereignty. I determine free speech. I have a Supreme Court. I have a currency. The government should support me and regulate me, but I am the locus of legitimacy. And Elizabeth Warren and many others, it's not just her, there are a lot of other politicians that are saying this, but she's the most high-profile one, are saying, no, it's public institutions. It's the public through its elected leaders that makes the decisions about how society should be governed.
So that was Matt Stoller of the Open Markets Institute. You can follow him on Twitter at Matthew Stoller. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.